TNA. This is gonna be good. 3 hour Raws. Watch this. Eva Marie. I'm just kidding. TNA. I swear that never gets old.
A gang, Mean Gene Okerlund. Hey, we've got some celebrating to do. Congratulations to my very dear, close, personal, longtime friend, Jason Solomon, of a little number called, get this, Solomonster Sounds Off. It's a podcast. This guy started the podcast back in 2007. He's from Brooklyn, New York. Royal Rumble, favorite one, 1992. I heartily agree. A huge Bobby Heenan fan, how about me? 28 years with the guy. We went to lunch at La Bretagne, a nice French restaurant. Heart, kidney, liver, you name it, every body organ in the world. And Bobby Heenan said, they don't need a maitre d', they need a coroner. Well, that's the brain for you. 400th episode on 9/13. Congratulations. It's fast, but I hail you. Jason Solomon and Solomeister Sounds Off.
Welcome to the 2015 Solomonster Sounds Off Halloween Special. And now, here's your host with the most from coast to coast, the Solomonster.
It's always nice to see you, Zombie Solomonster, even though we only get to see each other once a year. What'd you think of the Walking Dead last Sunday?
I loved every second of it.
Ah, don't say that. I still haven't fully recovered from what happened last weekend. This is episode 407 of the Solomonster Sounds Off here for Sunday, November 1st, 2015. I am the Solomonster, a special Halloween edition of the Sound Off, my favorite holiday of the year, and I feel like it just went by. You know, I didn't even have a chance to watch any Halloween movies. I just haven't had time. I'm going to have to go back now in November here and watch them. It's not going to be quite the same thing. But I hope everybody had a safe and happy Halloween. I had a very interesting Halloween. I bumped into Aaron Paul. That's right, Jesse Pinkman from Breaking Bad. Just hanging out at the Halloween party that we were at the other night, wearing Undertaker's eyeliner. You can see the photo online. I put it up on Twitter. I want to say thanks to Bobby Waldrop, one of our loyal listeners, for the shout-out from Mean Gene Okerlund that you heard there. It's part of the intro, one of the all-time greats, WWE Hall of Famer. And see, even he agrees with me on that 1992 Royal Rumble. I'm not the only one. But anyway, Bobby was able to get that shout out. It was actually several weeks ago, right around the time we celebrated our 400th episode. And I just wasn't able to get it over to me until now. So that put a smile on my face when I heard that. So again, big thank you to Bobby for that. We are continuing our 8-year anniversary countdown that I've been doing now for several weeks. Of course, next weekend is the 8-year anniversary episode of the Sound Off. And we will finish this list, this countdown, 8 of my favorite WWE matches of all time. We are 6 matches deep so far, with match number 7 coming up later on in the podcast. We're going back to the Attitude Era for this one. Second time that, actually maybe third time that we've done that here in this countdown. It is a match that surprised a lot of people, myself included. Surprised me in a good way. And I'll leave it at that. So that's coming up a little bit later. Got to mention Audible here. Audible trial is still continuing for everybody who wants to take advantage of it. You can use our link, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. We only got 2 months left in the year, and I want to finish strong. So if you haven't taken advantage of this yet, now is the time to do so. If you can get other people to sign up for it, just give them the link. They got to go through the sign-up process. None of this matters if you don't actually sign up. You can't just plug in the link and get the free book. You got to sign up for the trial. You could sample the service free for 30 days. When you do so, you get one free audio book that you get to keep no matter what. You can listen to it at home. You can listen to it on the go. These are great. Everybody that's tried it out seems to really like it. There's a lot of wrestling books up there. Daniel Bryan's new book is up there. You've got Chris Jericho, Hulk Hogan, Shawn Michaels, Lex Luger, Dusty Rhodes. I even hear there's a book on there about the Junkyard Dog. I'm just saying, that's what I've heard. So use our link, audibletrial.com/Solomonster, and sign up. Get your free book. And also a big thank you to people who have donated this week via PayPal to the podcast. You can always do so on the Solomonster.com. The PayPal box is on the right-hand side of the page. It is the easiest, most direct way to support this podcast if you choose to do so. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. $30 or more will get you a nickname and a quick shout-out for your own podcast or YouTube channel here on this show, which reaches a lot of people, in case you didn't know. So thank you this week to Deadpool, James Herrera, John Loose Cannon Lopez, No Mercy, Nick Horacek, CJ Ring the Bell La Chapelle, Will the Alabama Crab Dangle Bullard, and I promise you I did not come up with that name myself. That was his choice. Pretty cool name, though. And Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray. Thank you to you guys that made the donations this week. I really do appreciate that. And again, you can always do so on thesolomonster.com. Now, let's talk about Hell in a Cell last weekend. And I want to mention this before we get into some quick Hell in a Cell thoughts. I just want to make sure people understand, because I think they get spoiled sometimes. I throw the post-show reviews for these pay-per-views up on YouTube when I can. There is no consistency to it. If you look at the body of the year, I would say the large majority of the time, there is no pay-per-view review separate from this podcast. When I have a day off or I have free time and I'm able to do it, I jump on it. And I get the reviews up on the YouTube channel. It's a great thing for me to do for the channel, especially get more subscribers. People seem to enjoy it. I get my thoughts out there a little bit quicker. I do it when I can. It's predicated on me having the time, which is not usually until the next day to even do one, right? But I have a full-time job. Typically, like a lot of you guys, I'm at the office on Monday morning and I'm there all day. And I get home just in time to get undressed and take a shower and watch Raw. I know, what a great routine on a Monday night. And then I try to scarf down a TV dinner when Raw starts at 8 o'clock. That's usually my typical Monday. I don't usually have the time to do these things. Again, unless I happen to have a day off or I take a day off or something like that, which I've done before. Okay, but again, I work just like you guys. So in a perfect world, I would be able to do this full time and just offer extra content for a fee. Right, not the main podcast, but like additional content for a fee, and just have all the time in the world to do nothing but sound off and sound off related content. Because believe me, if I ever went to a model like that, it would be a whole host of different content and audio that I would offer. I've got all these ideas floating in my head, but you know, maybe one day. Today is not that day. Right now, it's not practical. Okay, the rent has to be paid. So, and this ain't paying the rent, unfortunately. So. Can't do this show without a roof over my head. That's kind of important. So anyway, just go easy on me. There were a lot of people very upset. Oh, there's no YouTube review that went up. What's happening? You're slacking off. And I do the best I can with the time that I have. That's all I can do. So, Hell in a Cell from last weekend. Two strong Hell in a Cell matches. And a surprise return for Alberto Del Rio. To me, made this a good show overall. Far from perfect. I thought the Rollins-Kane title match was just terrible, just terribly boring. And the Kevin Owens match with Ryback, easily the worst pay-per-view match that Kevin Owens has had since coming up to the main roster. Maybe his worst match, period, not just on pay-per-view, since coming to the main roster. But, you know, you've got two great workers there in Rollins and Owens, and you look at who they were in the ring with, Kane and Ryback, which... You know, they can have a good match when they want to, but that's no easy task. You know, not that the blame falls entirely on Kane and Ryback only. You know, the other two I think are good enough that they should have been able to pull something great out of the other two, but they didn't. And those two matches were very disappointing. So just some observations. I mentioned something on Twitter that people seem to agree with, the pink rope, which is now going to be, I guess, an every October thing for Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Every October, ooh, the pink rope. The pink rope inside Hell in a Cell, that don't work. It doesn't exactly scream demonic. So maybe if they insist on doing this Hell in a Cell pay-per-view, which they shouldn't even do to begin with, they may just have to move it to a different month because that pink rope inside the cage just doesn't work. I can't say that I saw the Del Rio return coming, although I did talk about the fact that WWE was interested in bringing him back. I talked about this like a week or two ago. I did not see him being the one to answer the open challenge, and I sure as hell didn't see him coming out with Zeb Coulter. I thought Alberto looked great, you know, in the ring, physically. He looked just in the best shape I've ever seen him in. Apparently got himself a pretty sweet deal, too. Not the $1.5 million figure that's being floated around online, but still a lot of money, fewer dates. That obviously spells the end of his run with Lucha Underground and with AAA. The problem there is he's still the AAA Mega Heavyweight Champion, and AAA was under the impression that he would be allowed to wrestle a few more dates for them and drop the belt, but WWE has gone and booked him on those dates, and so who knows what's going to happen now with the championship. It's still a pretty cool feat for him to simultaneously hold titles in both WWE and AAA, at least for a little while longer. He won't be champion for much longer there, but that's still pretty cool. Nice feather in his cap. Del Rio, as you are all well aware by now, beat Cena. He is the new United States champion. Very weird to see one kick, one short little super kick to the head, beat John Cena when John Cena was kicking out of all of Seth Rollins' stuff in every single match that they had. Seth Rollins, by the way, the WWE World Heavyweight Champion. And it seemed like he couldn't throw enough stuff at John Cena. None of it was mattering anyway, because Cena would just kick out of it. Remember that match they had on Raw where I think it was Rollins did that frog splash? He busted out the frog splash for the first time, which is an amazing frog splash. He gets quite a bit of height on it. And not only did John Cena kick out of it, John Cena no-sold it and ended up rolling over and turning it into an attitude adjustment. It was just, he killed the move on night one. But that was the story of every single match those two guys had. Same thing with Dolph Ziggler. Remember that match with Cena and Ziggler a few weeks ago? I think Ziggler busted out two of his finishing moves in that match, and Cena kicked out of those too. So, anyway, I just thought that was weird. Not that I'm not in favor of having finishes like that that come out of nowhere and trying to get over new moves. I'm all for that. I just thought it was weird that it was one kick that beat Cena when Cena was kicking out of everybody else's shit now for the last few months. Probably years even. So Cena's gone now until December. He may be coming back a couple weeks earlier than originally expected. He'll probably be at the TLC pay-per-view, but either way, we will not be seeing him for at least another month. So we get a little bit of a respite from him for now. Roman Reigns and Bray Wyatt, I thought their Hell in a Cell match was a great match. I know some people will disagree with me. Some people were vehemently disagreeing with me on Twitter. What's so great about that match? I just thought it was a great match. You know, it exceeded my expectations. Maybe my expectations were very low going in. But I thought they did about as good a job as they could do. I just did a column for TJRWrestling.net. My latest one is actually on Roman Reigns. It's very complimentary of Roman Reigns and the fact that I think he's come a long way in the 3 years since The Shield debuted. I think he gets a lot of flack unfairly, a lot of unjustified criticism from people. He's not perfect. There's certain things about him I can criticize, but I just think a lot of the criticism is just way overblown. I don't see anything wrong with Roman Reigns. I think Roman will be just fine if WWE can kind of pull their head out of their rear end and stop screwing the guy over. You know, it's funny to me that they want so badly for Roman Reigns to get over and to be the next John Cena, and he's going to be the face of the company. Obviously, he's going to get the title at some point. And I know they want him to succeed. It's not like they're trying to sabotage this guy, but when they send him out there, when put a microphone in his hand to cut these long-winded promos, and they put him in these situations sometimes, it just makes you scratch your head. It's like you've seen that this doesn't work. This guy has made progress since WrestleMania this year. I know the crowds are not 100% for him. They'll never be. But it's better now than it was 6 months ago. And they still make the same mistakes. They just did it, you know, last week again. And I'm still, and I talk about it in my column, I still pitch the idea of silent but deadly. Silent but deadly for Roman Reigns. And now he's going to get a title match at Survivor Series, and I'm thinking it's too early. I'm actually thinking that it would be a mistake to put the title on him now, and it would be to his benefit to do one of two things. You either do a double switch with him and Rollins, because I do think long-term the best spot for Rollins is as a babyface. And I just, you know, wonder if this isn't the time to pull the trigger on that. It's not like we haven't seen the seeds of dissension planted between Seth Rollins and Triple H. Seth Rollins and the Authority. You know, right now they're on great terms. Next week, Rollins will say or do something to piss them off, and they'll be on bad terms. And this has been playing out month after month after month. At some point, it wouldn't be too far-fetched if the Authority said, you know what, we've had enough of this guy's crap. Roman Reigns, welcome to the club. Thanks for coming around. They do the double turn. Roman goes heel. He's the Authority's boy. And Rollins now has to fight back against the Authority, try to get his belt back now as a babyface this time. And you could build to that eventual Triple H Seth Rollins match. I'd be shocked if they end up not doing it at some point, even if it's not at WrestleMania. I mean, I know they want to do Rock and Triple H, but, you know, at some point, I would have to think we're going to see those two in the ring together. So that's one idea that you could do. Or you could just not turn Roman heel. You can keep him babyface, but have something happen to him in that match, whether it's Dean Ambrose turning on him or whatever it may be, and it just drives him into this prolonged period of silence where, you know, he's angry and hurt and pissed off and just wants to kick everybody's ass and get back at the Authority and get back at Ambrose or whatever happens. But you can do that by not putting a mic in his hand. You know, he can come out, he can have this pissed off look on his face. I know, you know, it's very similar, I guess, in a way to what WCW did with Sting, except instead of having Sting come down from the rafters, you've got Roman walking down through the crowd. But I think that's the way to go. I really don't think it's going to make him any less over not to talk. If it works, a few months from now, people are going to be dying to hear from the guy. And even then, I would still hold off a little bit, make them want it that much more. And I think going into WrestleMania season, it would really be to his benefit to do something like that, as opposed to putting the belt on him now. I just feel, you know, you're running the risk of undoing all the positive stuff, all the good stuff since WrestleMania, all the progress they've made. If you put the title on him and people just start booing him, maybe just wait a little bit longer. But you got to make that tweak in the character. If it's just the Roman Reigns we see now who goes out there and he's got the smile, he's doing the Susan G. Komen stuff, you know, that's a great thing and all, but that's not what they need to be doing with Roman Reigns right now. So I talk a little bit about that and some other stuff in the column if you want to check it out. Brock Lesnar and The Undertaker, Hell in a Cell, turned out to be not as bloody as the original one they had back in 2002, but any blood really was a surprise, a pleasant surprise. Now, the controversy is, did they blade themselves? Was it hard way? Was Vince McMahon pissed? Was he not pissed? You know, they both bled, especially Brock, pretty early on in the match, in fact. There was a spot where he got sent into the ring post, hit the post with the top of his head, and instantly, you know, it started bleeding. I don't think they bladed, personally. I just don't see it. But honestly, who gives a shit? Who cares? We got some color, which is something we need to see in these Hell in a Cell matches. I'm sorry, I know it's safer for them not to blade anymore like they used to, and you know, I'm okay with that. They don't need to be bleeding every week, every month. It does mean more. You know, the fact that we had blood the way we did in this match, you know, it wasn't a gusher, but it was a fair amount. It was pretty cool. Now, if you were doing that every single month, it wouldn't mean anything. So I'm okay with that. But if you insist on having these types of cage matches, then a little bit of blood goes a long way. I'm sorry. You're going to have you're going to build up the brutality of a Hell in a Cell match. It's the most violent, vicious match in WWE. And you take these two big bulls and you put them in there, and you want them to use the cell as a weapon, which they don't really do a lot of anymore, but you know, some guys do. And you don't have any blood. It just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. So I give props to both these guys for going in there and doing what they did. Now, the weird thing about it is, you talk about, well, they don't do blading anymore, and therefore it's a lot safer, and, you know, to the outside world, I mean, it makes sense if you think about it. The idea that you would cut yourself intentionally in the head with a blade just for your, you know, your performance, it sounds kind of barbaric. I could see where people would think that. But it's actually more dangerous for these guys to be busting themselves open hard way. Like, hey, dude, seriously, I want you to punch me in the face for real. That's basically what happened in this match. Undertaker was taking some shots in the fucking face. You couldn't pay me enough money to take those kind of shots from Brock Lesnar. And he got busted open. And then you've got Brock, who's like, well, fuck it, I'll do what I did at WrestleMania, right? He did the same thing there. I'm going to ram my head into the steel post. That sounds a hell of a lot less safe to me than just taking a little blade and cutting yourself on the forehead. So when you have guys doing this, the only reason they're doing it is because they're not allowed to blade anymore. poor Batista got fined $100,000, you know, however many years ago it was. And being the stand-up guy that he is, Jericho tells a story in his book. He said to Jericho, who was his opponent in that cage match on Raw, he's like, no, I'm going to pay your fine. I'm going to pay the referee's fine, or the agent, whoever it was that got fined. Vince McMahon went nuts because they bladed in a cage match on Raw, and so everybody got fined, and Batista paid everybody's fine, over $100,000, for blading in a fucking cage match on Raw. See, there's a guy, Batista, who still gets flack from people, but there's a fucking guy that, you know, I have a lot of respect for him. Batista's an old school guy. When he does interviews, he even talks about the fact it's not the same, it's not how it used to be. Like, you know, he's like, fuck it, we're going to make this match better. We're going to fucking cut ourselves open and get some blood. And then he's like, fuck it, I'm going to pay your fine too. It's not your fault. I'll take the hit for it. Yeah, that's a stand-up guy right there. Batista does things the right way. He's the kind of guy who also would have went into a match like this if he were still around and probably would have done the same thing and would have told Undertaker, fuck it, let's get some color here. You know, those are the guys that I miss. Those are the guys, we need more of those guys in wrestling. So Vince McMahon, there was a lot of rumors. He was completely freaked out by the first sight of blood. And here's what happened, supposedly. Here's what happened. It wasn't so much the blood. He got very upset when Brock Lesnar shoved the doctor down. They sent a doctor into the ring, into the war zone there, to try to clean off Brock Lesnar's cut about midway through the match, which would explain why they never bothered showing us a replay of that when they showed us a replay of 50 million other things on this show, which is becoming more and more of a problem. I first talked about this how many months ago? When I wasn't hearing anybody else talk about this, I'm like, am I the only one who is just completely fed up with all of these goddamn replays they keep showing us during these shows? And since I talked about it, it's only gotten worse. Now we're missing important parts of the action in favor of something that we saw 30 seconds earlier, and they feel the need to do it from five different camera angles. I mean, it's out of control. I mean, the match that I'm going to review, you know, this week's match, it's match number 7 that we're going to do later in this top 8 countdown. I went back, and this goes back to the Attitude Era, and I watched the match again, and it struck me, watching that match. Yeah, you got a few replays during it, but only after, like, the big, big spots. You didn't have this flood of replays, every single high spot, every single move interrupting the match. You didn't have that. So it didn't interrupt the flow of the match. I'm watching this thing, and I'm actually noticing this now, and I'm like, holy shit, it's a lot easier to watch this match. If that match had happened now, forget about it. For all the weapons and the spots that were used in that match that we're going to talk about later, we would have had nothing but replays the whole time. So it's bad. I mean, it's really bad. It interrupts the flow of a match. It's almost as bad as the commercials they take in the middle of the matches now, which is also something they didn't do as much of back then, although at least that I can understand. There's no justification for showing us a fucking replay after every little move. If they want to do that, I would almost wish that they would wait until the end of the match and then show us like a video package of all the replays. That's what WCW used to do back in the day. I don't think WCW ever showed an in-match replay. I could be wrong, but I know for a fact there was a period, at least, if not the entire duration of Nitro's run, and probably Saturday Night and a lot of their other shows, they would not show you a replay as the match was going on, which actually makes sense. You know, now if there's a lull in the action or a huge high spot, both guys are just laid out on the outside, there's nothing going on, okay, fine, then I can understand it. You can show as many replays as you want to. But WCW back in the day, they would let the match play out, and when the match was over, they would go to a highlights video. That makes sense. Kevin Dunn now has his fancy little slow-mo camera, which is great, right? It looks cool. But it's like he feels the need, oh, I have to use this. I have to use, look at that guy. He just did a fucking clothesline. Let's get that from five different angles and show it in slow-mo. They need to chill out with the replays. It's completely out of hand at this point. And now we're missing parts of the action. You know, it'd be bad enough just to have them in the middle of the match, even if we weren't missing anything important. Now we're missing important shit that's relegated to a little tiny box on the TV. I want to see what's going on. I don't want to see what I just saw, you know, 30 seconds ago. I fucking saw it. I know what happened. The ending of the match with the low blow by Lesnar, I thought was perfect. Just perfect. after what Undertaker has done to him in the past few months. The dick kicker got what he deserved. Although I think, you know, what would have made this even better would have been if Undertaker had tried to kick Lesnar in the balls again. Only this time it has no effect because Brock smartened up and was wearing a cup. Then he kicks Undertaker low instead. And then he gives him the F5 and he pins him. See, that I think would have been amazing. That would have been an incredible finish. Match was over. Wyatt family comes out. They beat down the Undertaker. They abduct him to close the show, clearly leading to a Survivor Series elimination match. They're already promoting Survivor Series as 25 years of the Undertaker. It is the 25th anniversary right down to the day of Undertaker's debut at Survivor Series as Ted DiBiase's mystery partner, November 22nd, 1990. And this year it's November 22nd, 2015. So you have to do something with the Undertaker. Makes sense, right? 25 years to the day? I mean, come on. And as far as what the teams might be, obviously it'll be, if they do this, it'll be Wyatt, Harper, Strowman, and Rowan against Undertaker. You would think Kane, obviously, has to be on that team, especially after what happened on Monday night. And Reigns and Ambrose would make sense as far as rounding out the team, especially given their involvement with the Wyatt family recently. Except Roman Reigns is wrestling Seth Rollins for the championship. So to me, it ain't going to be Roman Reigns and Dean Ambrose. I mean, it could be Ambrose, but then you still got to find a fourth guy. As far as who the other two are going to be, I don't know yet. I have to wait and see how things play out. You know, you could put Randy Orton in there if Randy Orton is ready to come back. You know, Randy Orton did have the whole thing where the Wyatts had taken him out. To me, it just seems like they've completely forgotten about that, but you could potentially put him in there. You could just plug in Orton and Ambrose and let Reigns wrestle for the title. You could do that. I don't think they will. I'd say Sting. Sting would make sense. You know, if originally the plan was to have Sting do something with the Wyatt family for SummerSlam, that was an idea on the table at one point. They didn't go in that direction. The idea of putting Sting and Undertaker together, even if they end up not wrestling, if they at least team up in a match, I think that would make a lot of people very happy. And if Sting is still not 100%, you know, he's in a tag team match. So it's not like he's in a singles main event like he was against Seth Rollins. I think it's pretty cool, the idea of Undertaker, Sting, and Kane on the same team. And then as a fourth guy, again, you could put in Randy Orton. You know, that's a pretty strong team right there. I would think the likelihood is slim just because Sting's pretty messed up right now. And it's actually really likely he may never wrestle another match in WWE again. But I think it's probably too soon for him to be put back in the ring. So we'll see. Let's talk about Raw from last Monday night. Monday Night Raw was live from San Diego, California. There was a rare occurrence last Monday, an actual good episode of Raw, top to bottom. I had forgotten what those looked like. And according to the Sound Off Twitter poll I threw up after the show, because now you can do polls on Twitter, out of 782 votes, a whopping 68% of you guys gave the show a thumbs up, compared to 32% thumbs down. A lot of wrestling on this show. It's amazing how that works in terms of the quality of the show. A lot of wrestling. No John Cena. No Randy Orton. This was the Roman Reigns show, and by the end of the night, he became number one contender to the WWE title at Survivor Series. I don't even know if they've officially announced that match for Survivor Series. I'm just assuming it will happen there. It was a good night for Roman also because the crowd was behind him, I think, in a way that they haven't been in a very long time. You'll always have your scattered boos, but he was largely cheered here in San Diego. They set things up at the start of the show with Stephanie McMahon announcing some of the winners from the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view the night before would be competing against each other in singles matches. Those four winners would be meeting then at the end of the night in a fatal four-way to determine the number one contender. So, in the first match, Kofi Kingston lost to Roman Reigns. Kingston and Big E came out saluting their fallen comrade Xavier Woods, throwing up the unicorn sign, sporting black armbands with the initials XW on them. My brother was watching the show with me and asked me if Woods was dead or something. Was it, is this guy dead? And I told him he was. And he just kept watching the show. Didn't really seem too bothered by it either. So Reigns won with the spear. Kevin Owens pins Cesaro, another really good match, with the pop-up powerbomb. Match that got chance of "This is awesome" down the stretch. Unfortunately, Vince McMahon did not hear them. He did not hear them as "This is awesome." He thought they were chanting "We want Cena," I'm sure. Poor bastard, that Cesaro. Guy can't ever catch a break. Paige was backstage on the phone with possibly the only person whiter than she is, Conan O'Brien. She was on Conan's show last week, so I guess now they're supposed to be buddies. Charlotte and Becky walked in. Paige wanted to shake hands with them. She was so busy talking about herself. You know, the idea here is that she's so self-absorbed. She thinks she's the star of the show. And she said, no, listen. I want to shake hands. We're all together. Team PCB. Let's do our little pinky swear deal. And Charlotte warned her. Charlotte told her, if I find out that you were the one who attacked Natty, I guess this must have happened on SmackDown, the attack on Natalya. I find that impossible, because of course, as you all know, if it happened on SmackDown, it didn't happen. But she said if it turns out to be her, if she finds out that Paige was behind it, there's going to be hell to pay. And Paige denied it. She said Natty was her best friend. She would never attack her. Of course, because in wrestling, best friends never attack each other or stab each other in the back. So Charlotte fell for this, by the way. You'd think that she would know better, given that her own father made Sting look like an idiot back in the day for trusting him. But nope, nobody ever learns anything here in wrestling. Team Bella beat Team PCB when Nikki pinned Becky with the rack attack. After the match, we finally got the official heel turn from Paige. For real this time, I think. Who the hell knows? These baby faces are idiots. Can never be too sure. I enjoyed this. I enjoyed the turn, the way it was executed. Paige just beat the hell out of both of them, laid them both out with the rampage. She put Charlotte in the PTO for good measure. Lots of cheers for Paige after this. Best part about the turn now, I think, is that we can get matches with Paige against Charlotte, Paige against Becky, maybe Paige and Sasha, get Sasha in the mix. She was nowhere to be seen, by the way, on this show. Maybe in a backstage segment that I missed when I was flipping channels. She definitely was not in a match, so I don't know what the hell's going on with Sasha Banks. We got a Zeb Coulter promo on this show backstage with Alberto Del Rio. They've created a new country now called Mex-America. Donald Trump, I'm sure, is appalled by this. Donald Trump promises to build half a wall for the Mex part of that country so people can climb over to the America side. Del Rio had a match with Neville. By the way, I read that, I forgot where I read this, Sheamus and King Barrett apparently are now considered an official tag team. I say good. I pitched that exact idea on the show a few weeks ago. Go ahead and make the two of them a team, call them the European Union, whatever name you want to come up with for them. It's better than Barrett and Neville. Barrett was angling for a tag team with Neville. He did some interviews and said, I would love to be a tag team wrestler, I want Neville to be my partner. I said, no. That would not be good for Neville. So if it is Sheamus and Barrett, I'm very happy to hear that. Del Rio and Neville was a really good match. It was a fresh match, a match we've never seen before. Del Rio has been in beast mode so far since coming back on these shows. The finish here was no different. He had Neville upside down in the corner in a tree of woe. Del Rio then jumped off the top rope in that same corner and came down with a double foot stomp that caught Neville right in the face. I saw some people, when they were talking about, oh, he hit him in the shoulder. No, he hit him in the face with his two boots. Oh, my God, did that look brutal. And he won with it, too. That might have been an even bigger shock, as he should have. You do a move like that, you better be winning that match. I can't tell you how many times I've seen matches, and this is in WWE. This is in Ring of Honor, especially. It's one of my knocks on ROH. You will see guys pull off an amazing move or a brutal move. And it's only good for a near fall. Actually, I think I talked about that last week on Ring of Honor. They had the street fight with Adam Page and Jay Briscoe. And Jay Briscoe did the J-Driller on Adam Page through a table outside the ring. Now, the J-Driller by itself is a brutal move. I think he won with it in the end. But he did the J-Driller through a table on the floor and then rolled him back inside. And that was only good for a two count. I mean, really? You do a move like that, dude, you better be winning the match with it. But I'll tell you what, I could warm up to Del Rio real quick if he keeps this up. When I talked about him a few weeks ago, and there were just rumors at that point about him maybe coming back, I asked the question. I said, is anybody really clamoring for an Alberto Del Rio return? Because just think about what he was doing the last time he was there before he got, you know, fired. He wasn't really doing much. It was just, he was just there. There was nothing exciting about him or the character. It just, he seemed totally played out. Yeah, I guess it's amazing what going away for a year, year and a half, whatever it was, you know, what that could do for a guy. And he went away and he was very successful. He went to Lucha Underground, he went to AAA, he became champion down there, he was working other indies and doing, I mean, he was keeping himself in the mix. And so now he comes back after having done all of that, and he physically, he looks, you know, like I said, in the best shape of his career. And it's done a world of good for this guy. And, you know, if he keeps this up, this mean streak he's got going on for him, I can warm up to him real quick. I even said on Twitter, I think a match with Del Rio and Cesaro could be incredible. Or even Del Rio and Lesnar. Maybe down the road they could build that up, too. I'm all for getting fresh opponents for Brock Lesnar. So doing Del Rio and Lesnar at some point, I'm okay with that. I think that's a hell of an idea. Speaking of Neville, he had a match with Rusev at the SmackDown tapings that had to be stopped because Rusev got hurt. He suffered a bicep tendon rupture that's going to keep him out about 3 to 4 weeks. And this is not a sad tweet, but I'm giving this tweet of the week honors. I'm giving it to Rusev, at RusevBUL on Twitter. He said, I forgive my bicep for being so big the tendon could not hold it anymore. I just think Rusev is awesome. This fucking guy, he's great. The Wyatt family came out for a promo. Michael Cole sounded more concerned about why Bray Wyatt did what he did to The Undertaker at Hell in a Cell, instead of asking the actual question that was on people's minds, which is, where the hell did they take The Undertaker? It's unbelievable to me. I'm like, perhaps we'll learn why Bray Wyatt did what he did. Who gives a fuck why? How about asking where he is? So Bray Wyatt talked and talked and talked and talked and really didn't say anything of any particular substance. Dolph Ziggler pinned Big E with the zigzag to move on to the Fatal 4-Way later in the show. Tyler Breeze and Summer Rae both were sitting ringside in a special little VIP lounge they set up. It was all blocked off by a velvet rope. She was feeding him grapes. They had Titus O'Neil host the weekly Susan G. Komen breast cancer awareness segment in the ring. Even if it was only because John Cena wasn't there, I thought it was much better having Titus do this than, say, Roman Reigns. And that's not because I don't think Roman wouldn't do a good job talking about this kind of stuff, but just I don't want to see Roman doing that. Titus, though, Titus is great with stuff like that. And it shines a spotlight on somebody other than John Cena or Roman Reigns for a change. Like, Titus O'Neil actually felt kind of important, looking at him being front and center in the ring, kind of being the MC of this whole thing. I still think they're not taking full advantage of what they have with this guy. Roman Reigns pinned Kevin Owens in the Fatal 4-Way to end the show, match that also included Alberto Del Rio and Dolph Ziggler, to become the new number one contender to the WWE Championship. Seth Rollins was on commentary for this match. This was a really good match. I wish Cesaro had made it in, but they didn't want the crowd to boo Roman. I'm sure that was the reason why, so I get it. And look, it was Owens against Cesaro. I'm okay with either one of those guys winning and being in the main event. I just think, I kind of wish they would have put Cesaro in with somebody else and had Cesaro win, and then, you know, he goes on to the Fatal 4-Way. But anyway, I guess they saw it differently. With the other two down, Del Rio was out, Ziggler was out, it came down to Reigns and Owens, the crowd was amped up for it. Like, these two guys are staring each other down, the crowd's going nuts, it feels like it's like the arena is shaking. You don't see that reaction very often these days. So Kevin Owens sent him into the ropes for the pop-up powerbomb, but on his way down, Roman caught him with a Superman punch and followed it up with a spear for the pin. Great little finishing sequence there. Everybody looked strong, yes, including Roman. And I just thought this was great, and I thought it was the best thing they could have done with Reigns on this show. They actually had a good week as far as how they used him, and he went and stared down Seth outside the ring when the match was over, and it looks like we've got our championship match now for Survivor Series. Some quick thoughts on Breaking Ground. Some people wanted me to just talk about this. It's that new show on the network. It's kind of done like HBO Hard Knocks. They follow around different people from NXT on their journey from there to the main roster. And this, at least this episode, I'm not sure if this is indicative of the whole season. if they're going to focus on different people every episode or if these are the guys they're going to focus on for the duration. But they focused on Apollo Crews, Baron Corbin, a guy by the name of Tino Sabatelli, who used to play in the NFL. Actually, I guess Baron Corbin did too. And Devin Taylor, who, spoiler alert, they've already released. In fact, they may actually show that on the show coming up this week, because that was the tease when this episode was over. Somebody was being called into the principal's office, and they were likely going to be released. I don't know if it's going to be Devin or not, but she is gone. The other person they focused on is, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Nymph Alaribi is her name. She's 19 years old. I believe she's Indian. Very frustrated on the show that they won't allow her to wrestle matches in front of a live crowd. She thinks she's ready, and everybody just keeps getting opportunities before her. We saw William Regal at one point during this special explaining to the NXT talent the importance of connecting with the audience by looking into the camera, which is hilarious in so many ways. Although I will say, you do see people looking into the main camera on the NXT roster. You see that a hell of a lot more than you do on the main roster. So I guess it kind of makes sense, right? He's impressing upon the NXT people, this is what you need to do, because they do more of that down there than they do once you're brought up. But I just find it so funny that this is apparently so important that William Regal tells them to do this, and yet on the main roster, you hardly ever see guys looking into the camera. They're always looking at the other person. They're looking off camera. I guess somebody is, I don't know, having sex in front of them behind the scenes, and they're like fixated on this. I don't know what they're looking at. I just thought it was hilarious that Regal would be teaching them to do something that they're probably never going to do once they get to the main roster. I thought it was a good episode. Obviously, I'll be watching every week. I think it's worth going out of your way to see. It's only half an hour long, which is the perfect length. Not too long, not too short. If I had to say somebody was the star of this first episode and really showed a lot more of themselves and their personality maybe than we've seen before, it would be Baron Corbin. Corbin comes off as being this almost like dickish bully type. Maybe bully's not the right word, but he comes off as a guy who's completely full of himself. You know, like his shit don't stink. He wants to be the guy. He's better than everybody else. And, you know, he's big and he's got the background that he has and he thinks very highly of himself. And there's actually nothing wrong with that. You know, maybe that's part of the problem why guys these days don't get over the way that they used to. You know, a guy like Cesaro, who has all the talent in the world, I'm guessing, does not really put up much of a fuss behind the scenes. I don't know that he's ever cornered Vince McMahon in the hallway and said, "Hey, motherfucker," maybe as he should, and say, what you got a problem with me? Let's hash it out. Like, what's the problem here? Because I could be your number one guy. Just give me the chance. Give me the ball, I'll run with it. I get the impression Cesaro probably has not done that. But Baron Corbin's the kind of guy who I could see if he makes it to the main roster and maybe things aren't going his way. You know, I don't know, you know, maybe he pitches a fit about it and he goes to Triple H or he goes to Vince McMahon and says, "Hey, I'm money, you need to push me, you need to do this with me." I could see this guy, you know, doing something like that. Some guys have the drive to do that. Other guys just don't want to make waves. They don't want to interrupt the status quo. I'm just going to leave things the way they are. Baron Corbin does not strike me as being that kind of guy, which may speak well for how far he'll go in the future. So anyway, we saw a little bit more of his personality here on this show than we ever have before. He comes across like an actual human being and not a character. And I think that's what I like about this show, is that what they're going for here, they want to show you the human side of these people, the real life side of what they go through and what they do. And for an era that they call the reality, or some people anyway, call the reality era, although I've heard Triple H refer to that as that before, very little actual reality shines through on their main TV shows, right? Like Raw and SmackDown. Very, very, very little. There's very few things on that show any given week that feels real or realistic that you can really just kind of get lost in and be like, "Holy shit, that was a great angle," or "Holy shit, that was a great promo." Very, very little do we get of that kind of thing on Raw and SmackDown. It's stuff like this, if you want, you know, you pull the curtain back a little bit, and it feels more like a sport almost, which I think is exactly the vibe they're going for. That's what I love about this. I want to see them do more of this kind of stuff on the network.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
Emma opened up NXT this week in a match against Shazza. Shazza is yet another female from Australia. There seem to be quite a few of those lately in WWE. She was the last person that Emma wrestled before she came over here to the States to come to WWE. She didn't really have a chance here to show much. Emma won quick with the Emma Lock. I'm really digging her new remix music, by the way. I think it's one of the better themes. Emma needs some wins like this if they want her to mean anything for when they feed her to Asuka. I have no doubt that's where they're going with this. So she needed a strong win, and she got one here. I just wish they would actually push her, not because they wanted to feed her to somebody else, but because, you know, they were actually going to do something with her. We got a taped backstage promo with James Storm after his debut on NXT last week. Guy looks so happy. He looks so happy here. He looked like a free man. Like, sentenced to 20 years, but free after 13 on good behavior. He said, "Sorry about your damn luck" to anybody that does not like him being on NXT. We got a Finn Balor video package to complement the one on Apollo Crews last week. Actually, we got part two of the Crews package this week as well. They've done a nice job of building up this title match next week, given how quickly they're doing it. Not a whole lot of turnaround time here. Balor came across like a total star. You know, Balor is maybe the one guy I'm not really worried about once he gets called down to the main roster, because it's obvious that they're banking on him being a big star, so I think the chances of them fucking up with Finn Balor are far less than it would be with most other guys. Like, not that they won't fuck up along the way, but I think in the end he'll be okay, because they've clearly got a lot invested in this guy. Jason Jordan and Chad Gable against Johnny Gargano and Tommaso Ciampa. What a fucking fantastic match. I love these guys to death, Jordan and Gable. They're so perfect together. And Gable is going to be a superstar. Superstar! If they don't drop the ball with him. You know, every now and again, they'll sneak a guy through who isn't completely ruined by creative. Please, I beg you, let Gable be one of those guys. Let him be the exception. This guy can go, and he's so damn fun to watch. You know, crowd was singing his name again to Kurt Angle's theme song. Gargano and Ciampa, I thought, were the perfect opponents for these guys. Great wrestlers. They more than held up their end here in this match. They got a lot of offense, too. It wasn't just one-sided. It was very back and forth, a very competitive, a long match. This was probably the best NXT match, not counting the TakeOver specials, just the regular episodes, that I've seen in months and months and months. This is one of the better matches you'll ever see on the regular weekly NXT television. Gable and Ciampa at one point did a Roman knuckle lock spot where neither man would let go. I don't want to describe it. Just watch it. That's something you really don't see every day. I haven't seen that move in a while, at least not in WWE. My favorite thing about this match might have been the part where Gable has, I think it was Ciampa, in an armbar. And he looks up at Jordan in the corner, just with a smile on his face, and he asks him, he goes, "Should I break it?" It's like asking permission, like, "Should I break it? I can break it, you know." Just awesome. And then he would tag in and say thank you to Jordan, and Jordan would say, "You're welcome." I'm not really sure who was supposed to be the heels and who was supposed to be the babyfaces here, because Gargano and Ciampa up to this point have been babyfaces, at least to the fans at Full Sail. But it almost didn't even matter here because Gable is so damn over, there was no way the crowd was going to root against him. It didn't even matter what Gargano and Ciampa did in this match. They were not going to be cheered more than Chad Gable and Jason Jordan. And they won their match here with the back suplex toss into a bridging suplex by Gable. You know, with Tyler Breeze now having moved on to the main roster, I can safely say these guys are my favorites. I hope they don't make the same mistake they made with Kaz and Enzo and wait too long to put the tag team titles on them. And they absolutely will put the tag team titles on them. But don't wait too long. You know, I don't know if the London TakeOver show in December, you know, is too soon for it. It may be. It may be too soon. But if not, if they don't do it there, they shouldn't wait too long after that. Just, you know, let them run through a few more teams first and then put the belts on them and give them a little run with them. But I just think these guys are tremendous. Eva Marie sent in another video, this time from Paris, and said that she'd be back real soon. hopefully all of the airplanes in France break down and cannot fly for months. We got yet another new NXT female making her debut here, Kaylee Ray. She is Scottish, I think. She's squashed, is what she is, more than Scottish. She wrestled Nia Jax, who, thank God, had new gear this week. All black, which works a hell of a lot better for her. That's kind of like what Awesome Kong would wear. But the all black, much better. Much better. Kaylee got some offense in, but Nia beat her with her standing spinebuster move and then gave her a leg drop before she pinned her. So I don't know if the leg drop is now part of her finishing combo. I think it's fine. It probably should be. Another win here for Nia Jax. Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy were jumped on their way to the ring by Dash and Dawson, so their match never got started. They took out Enzo. They worked over Cassidy's leg. They injured his knee. So the mechanics here, total dominance. Backstage, Alexa Bliss challenged Bayley to find two losers to team with her next week against Blake Murphy and herself. I would guess it's probably the Vaudevillains, but I don't know that. Main event was Samoa Joe against Tyler Breeze, stemming from when Breeze got Joe eliminated from that Battle Royal a few weeks ago. Good match. I don't know if this is Breeze's last NXT match. It might not be, but obviously his time there is very limited, given that he is now on the main roster. I don't foresee him being down here much longer. This is a good match, though. Great near fall on a supermodel kick by Breeze that Joe sold like he was dead, but he kicked out at two. Joe went for a muscle buster. Breeze escaped, rolled up Joe for a near fall, but the roll-up was such that when Joe kicked out, Breeze was in perfect position for the Coquina clutch, and Breeze had no choice but to tap out. So Tyler Breeze doing the honors here on his way out of the territory. But, yeah, we'll see if Joe gets involved at all next week in that title match between Balor and Cruz. If I were a betting man, I would say he does. But I guess we'll find out. And then it's just a matter of who, if anybody, goes heel. Because I still say the end game here is going to be a championship match in London between Balor and Joe. I'm sticking to my guns on that. You know, this whole Apollo Cruz thing, it's a little bump in the road on the way there. And you could do the match with both of them as babyfaces. You don't have to turn one guy heel, but I feel like there's a heel turn coming. And a lot of people seem to think that Finn Balor is going to be the one going heel, or that he should go heel. I mean, I saw some of his work, obviously, in New Japan. I mean, he was a heel over there, so maybe he's a natural at it. But I don't think that's what they have in the cards for him. I think if anybody's turning, it's going to be Joe. If I remember correctly, I'm pretty sure that the night that Joe made his debut was the same night that Hideo Itami got attacked in the parking lot and hurt his shoulder. Again, my timeline could be completely off here, but I think that happened on the same night, or it was supposed to have happened that same day. So you could definitely weave this into the Hideo Itami stuff, and Hideo's probably going to be able to come back any month now. And Joe, it turns out, was responsible for attacking him and laying him out, whatever his motivations were for that. And now he's a heel, and he's going to challenge for the championship. There's actually a lot of different ways you can go with the Hideo Itami stuff. You could have Hideo come back as a heel. You can have Hideo come back and kind of point the finger at Finn Balor, who was his friend, right? He was his best friend, and Finn goes heel, and Finn was the one to turn on Hideo. You could do that, too. I still say it's going to be Joe, though. And then when they ask him why he did what he did, he could say YOLO. All right, that was a bad joke. Let's talk about TNA here. Quick TNA news on Kurt Angle. Kurt Angle announced this week that he has signed on to appear at a FanFest event for the MMA promotion Bellator, and that he would be appearing as a spectator at their Bellator 145 event. When he first teased the announcement on Twitter, he made it sound like something much bigger than this, like he might be fighting for Bellator, especially since Ken Shamrock had been teasing a big announcement around that same time as well. So some people naturally thought it might be a tease for Angle against Shamrock in an MMA fight. Thankfully, Kurt Angle does seemingly want to live to see his kids grow up and will not be fighting, at least not yet. You never do know. But Bellator is looking for freak show attractions, and Kurt Angle's first MMA fight against whoever could be something they would want to do. I hope Angle has enough sense to say no if they ever do make that offer. Ring of Honor. I'm not done watching this past week's show yet. I did see the segment where Nigel McGuinness set up the TV title match between Jay Lethal and Roderick Strong, their final match. I believe it's in 2 weeks. They certainly didn't announce it as being next week, so I would assume it's probably 2 weeks away. But there are two pieces of ROH news I just wanted to get to here. First of all, the Young Bucks have signed deals. They've signed contracts with Ring of Honor, and it's a pretty sweet deal for them because they will be allowed to keep wrestling for New Japan. They will allow or be allowed to keep wrestling for PWG, where they really first made a name for themselves. And they are allowed to take international bookings so long as they don't conflict with any ROH dates. And on top of all that, they get to keep their t-shirt store on Pro Wrestling Tees. And it's funny, I still see some websites referring to this as an exclusive deal the Bucks have signed with Ring of Honor. It's like when WWE used to call John Cena the most controversial star of all time, and I would say he's not controversial. There isn't a damn thing controversial about this guy. He's the least controversial top star I've ever seen. He's polarizing. They would confuse the two words. Now at least they call him polarizing. They finally figured it out. I think I may have to start schooling some people on what the word exclusive means. I just love the idea. They've signed an exclusive deal with Ring of Honor that will allow them to work PWG and New Japan and international dates. It's like, then it's not an exclusive deal. I mean, there's probably another word you can come up with for it. Exclusive is not exactly the most appropriate word to be using in this case. And per the Wrestling Observer this past week, Steve Corino, who of course calls Ring of Honor shows with Kevin Kelly, is getting spinal fusion surgery very shortly. He shot an angle at the recent tapings that acknowledged the surgery. He said goodbye. That makes me very sad because I enjoyed his work with Kevin Kelly a lot. Until Lucha Underground comes back, I feel like we're losing the best weekly wrestling announced team on TV. So hopefully everything works out with his surgery. And you know, a surgery like that's very serious. If you're wrestling, you're usually not cleared to come back for at least a year. If Corino isn't wrestling, hopefully he can be back a lot sooner and they can put him back on commentary. Because, again, I really did become a big fan of him and Kevin Kelly. I think they have good chemistry together. Let's get to the mailbag. You can keep emailing me your questions, thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. I actually made a dent in my inbox this week. I went from 1,400 emails down to 1,330. That's progress, everybody. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Actually, I'm going to lump this in with the mailbag here, just because I've gotten a lot of emails and tweets from you guys asking me to talk about this. I haven't gotten emails from just one particular person, but I'll lump it in here. Wanting me to talk about this leaked WCW contract of Hulk Hogan that's been floating around online. Hulk Hogan's WCW contract is online, signed and dated June 2nd, 1998. Probably the last deal he ever signed with them. Splattered all over the internet this week. And credit where credit is due. Credit should be given to Chris Harrington at Mookie Ghana on Twitter. He was the one who dug this up. It had been included with some other documents from a racial discrimination suit filed against WCW many years ago. I guess evidence, whatever you want to call it. It came out in the court proceedings. What's interesting about that day, June 2nd, 1998, is that there had been rumors at that time of Hogan jumping back possibly to WWF earlier in the year and possibly being involved in an angle of sorts with Mike Tyson or maybe getting in on the one that they did with Austin. Hogan's contract with WCW was up. It was coming due. And as it turned out, it was just posturing on Hogan's part to gain some more leverage in his negotiations with WCW. And it sure looks like it paid off. Some highlights here from this contract. He got a $2 million signing bonus, because why not? 25% of the ticket revenue from all Nitro and Thunder events that he appeared on. That's a lot. 25%. He also got $20,000 per month for as long as he was part of the NWO, which sounds ridiculous, but I guess maybe from his end, he felt that he needed that money to help offset any money he was sacrificing by being a heel. That's the only possible explanation I can come up with that. Whatever money he felt he may be sacrificing in merch from the heel turn, this maybe was put in there to offset that. He got 50% of the profits from any Hulk Hogan merchandise that was sold, and a minimum $675,000 for any pay-per-view he appeared on, and more money on top of that, depending on the buy rate, and that additional money could be anywhere from $250,000 to as much as $1.7 million per show. Not to mention the, of course, creative control that he had over his match finishes. You know, and I see people ragging on Hogan for it. What a piece of crap, this guy, so selfish and so greedy. You know what I say? I say good for him. If I could get that kind of deal for myself, if somebody wanted me that badly, they were that stupid to give me every single thing that I asked for, then great. Good for me. And shame on the people who were willing to give it to me. Always ask for what you feel you're worth. Your boss should have the guts or the smarts to say no, or at least negotiate a contract that they think is fair. WCW wanted to blow this guy so badly, they put a towel down on the floor so they wouldn't get rug burn. Okay, they're the ones that made the deal. And hey, it may not have been the worst thing in the world. You could say these types of contracts are what contributed to the death of WCW. And they did. They contributed, at least. They weren't the sole reason. But, you know, without Hogan, and I don't know what his original contract looked like in 1994 when he first came over to WCW. I would imagine it was not radically different than the one here. It was probably also completely ridiculous. Without Hogan, though, all of that success that WCW enjoyed probably would never have happened. There was a noticeable uptick in buys and in business on many of those pay-per-view shows that they did with him. Even in 94-95, when Hogan was having those ridiculous matches with the Dungeon of Doom and all that other nonsense that was going on. I mean, I know for a fact when he first came in and had that big pay-per-view main event match at Bash at the Beach against Flair, that show did a hell of a buy rate. So Hogan was money right from the very start in WCW. Then you had the NWO in 96, and it just took off from there. I mean, that angle, that NWO angle, does not work without Hulk Hogan as the third man. If they do it with Sting, if they do it with Lex Luger, it just doesn't work. Sting never worked for Vince, Luger did, but Luger was not the right guy for that role. It was not going to work with him in there. So all of that success they enjoyed during the Monday Night Wars and the buildup of the Hogan-Sting match, over a year they built that match up, none of that would have happened without Hulk Hogan. You know, and it's frustrating to admit that because you look at stuff like this and you hear the stories from people in the company at the time and you think, my God, what a selfish prick. You know, he definitely did harm to that company. There's no doubt about it. But when you weigh the pros and cons of having Hogan on the roster at that time, the cons, I don't think, outweigh the pros by all that much. Even the Hogan haters out there have to begrudgingly admit that without the guy, it's very unlikely that WCW beats WWE for those 2 years that they did. And if that doesn't happen, then that changes everything. Kent from Philadelphia. What is your opinion on Mark Mero? And why does it seem like WWE has erased him from history? I personally think he doesn't get the respect and recognition that he deserves. He made the Johnny B. Badd character work in WCW, and his match with Steve Austin at the King of the Ring in 1996 was one of the best matches that year. He wrestled a very physical style, but could also do top rope high-flying maneuvers. Case in point, he was one of the first, if not the first, wrestler to do the shooting star press as a finisher. He's also one of the rare wrestlers who were accomplished athletes prior to wrestling. Having been in an amateur boxer who has won multiple gold gloves, his program with Sable is one of those storylines that never gets any mention when talking about the Attitude Era. I understand he's a motivational speaker now, giving speeches about his past battles with steroid abuse. He's been successful after his wrestling career was over and has not fallen into the drugs and health problems all too common with wrestlers from that era. I think Jushin Liger might have something to say to you, crediting the shooting star press to Mark Mero. Look, I think Mero was underrated as a worker. Not super underrated, but, you know, still underrated. To me, he was never the same after he came back from that knee injury. I think he had reconstructive knee surgery or an ACL replacement, whatever it was, major knee surgery that he had in 97. And he came back and he ditched the Wild Man gimmick for the marvelous Mark Mero stuff. And the reason that that happened was because he couldn't do all the high-flying stuff that he had done as the Wild Man. He had to adapt and adjust his style. He did have the Golden Gloves background, so it was a natural fit, I guess, to do the whole Marvelous Mark gimmick. But the flashy moves as the Wild Man that he used to do, that's what set him apart from everybody else, and all of a sudden, he didn't have that anymore. You know, he was just a guy. But the reason he's essentially been blackballed from WWE... And look, you never say never. We could see him back in their good graces one day, although I don't ever see him going into the Hall of Fame or anything like that. But he's on their persona non grata list right now after the Benoit stuff, when he made the media rounds with his, remember his list of dead wrestlers? He went on every single show on cable. I have my list, a literal list in his hand of all the dead wrestlers, talking about everything that's wrong with the business and why all the young guys were dying. He became the face of that. WWE would send people like Fit Finlay out there on all these shows to talk about how in WWE we put smiles on people's faces and we have our wellness policy and put a happy face on it, and there would be Mark Mero giving the opposing point of view, and that drove WWE absolutely nuts. This guy was on TV every single night talking to anybody who would listen, and that didn't exactly ingratiate himself to the folks in WWE. But, you know, he was standing up for what he felt was a noble cause. It had to be done. Nobody else was going to speak out for these guys. And, you know, he was friends with a lot of them. And I know he's spoken positively about the wellness policy and some of the changes that WWE has made in recent years. So if there's any sort of heat, it seems like it's only coming from WWE's end, not his. Nick from Germany. Ryback was on the Steve Austin show recently and said he told Vince McMahon that he could replace John Cena. I just wanted to know your thoughts on Ryback saying something like that to Vince. I say good for him. This goes to what I was talking about earlier when I was giving my Breaking Ground review and talking about Baron Corbin and how he comes off, and I could see him being the kind of guy where if things aren't going well for him on the main roster, he'd pitch a fit and talk to Vince or talk to Triple H. And there are guys right now who are not getting a fair shake, I think, on the main roster, and I name drop Cesaro, who, and I don't know this, but I don't see them doing that same thing. I don't see guys like that making waves behind the scenes and approaching Vince and cornering him and saying, hey, what's up? You know, you need to push me. You need to give me the ball to run with, and I can be your number one guy. And I give credit to Ryback for doing that. I laughed a little bit when I heard that, you know, because that's never going to happen. But good for him. I wish more guys would go to Vince and would speak up and speak their mind, you know, and feel the same way that Ryback feels about what he's capable of. I feel like a lot of guys just don't do that. So I give him a lot of credit. Joey from Canada. I was wondering whether or not the original plan was for a match between Marty Jannetty and Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 8. The infamous Rocker split occurred on the Barbershop in January 1992, which is traditionally around the time of year that storylines for Mania would start to take shape. I read that Jannetty was suspended on account of a drug violation around this time, so this made me think that maybe this was the original plan. Michaels eventually went on to face El Matador Tito Santana in the opener at Mania, but I don't recall exactly if there was much build to that particular match. Maybe you have some insight. Yeah, the only build, if you can even call it that, I think, to the Michaels-Santana match was the fact that they eliminated each other in that 1992 Royal Rumble match. Otherwise, I don't think there was any build. That may have been the build. What happened with Jannetty, though? What happened with Jannetty is this. That same month, I'm pretty sure it was after the Rumble. So I don't know that Jannetty was going to be involved in the Rumble at all. He was probably going to, at least for a few weeks, be selling the effects of the injury from the barbershop. But I'm pretty sure it was that same month, but it was after the Rumble. And I think the Rumble was on the 19th that year. It's crazy how much I know about that 1992 Rumble. You don't even want to ask. So, Jannetty was involved in some incident. I think he roughed up a police officer, I think, and he got arrested. And when he got arrested, they found drugs on him. And so WWF fired him at that point. So he didn't fail a drug test. That story's been going around for a long time. He didn't fail a drug test. Drugs were involved, but that's not exactly what happened. He got arrested, then he got fired, then he ended up on house arrest for, I think, most of that year. That's why they didn't bring him back until late 92. And that first match between Shawn Michaels and Jannetty didn't happen until the Royal Rumble in 1993. So it was a whole year after the barbershop deal. that they did that match. It was, you know, they couldn't pick it up. They couldn't pick up the feud because Jannetty was fired and then he was brought back. And by then, again, an entire year had gone by. And I think that kind of took the edge off that feud a little bit. But absolutely, I mean, there isn't a doubt in my mind that had he not been arrested, the plan would have been for a Michaels versus Jannetty match at WrestleMania 8. Absolutely 100% without question. And really, when you think about what that original WrestleMania 8 card probably would have looked like, it looks pretty amazing on paper. Obviously, Hogan versus Flair is a match that a lot of people feel should have happened at WrestleMania 8. And I'm sure very early on that was the plan, until they changed their mind and they went in a different direction. So you would have had Hogan versus Flair on top for the title. Maybe you could have then had the blow-off match on that show between Jake Roberts and Randy Savage. One of the all-time great and very underrated feuds, I think, in wrestling was the Savage-Jake stuff from late 91 into 92. And they blew it off in a Saturday night's main event match, and the blow-off belonged on a card like WrestleMania. And if they would have known Jake was leaving, which may have been a last-minute thing, I don't know how far in advance they knew, they could have even thrown in that stipulation, too, and made it loser leaves town. So you could have had that match underneath. You could have had maybe Sid against The Undertaker. You know, you don't turn Sid heel. You keep him babyface against Undertaker. They stick with Bret Hart against Roddy Piper. I think that was going to happen no matter what. They could have done LOD against Money Inc. for the tag team titles. Instead, what ended up happening was LOD lost the belt, I think, in February, like a month and a half before at some house show. They never even recorded the match, which, as the myth goes, was at the request of LOD. I don't know if that's true or not, but the match, I don't believe, was ever taped. They dropped the belts. It ended up being Money Inc. against the Natural Disasters. There was something happened at the time with LOD. I think they were gone. Then they ended up working out whatever the issue was. They immediately brought them back. So they were at WrestleMania 8, but all they did was a promo. They literally brought Hawk and Animal out in the Hoosier Dome in the middle of WrestleMania to do a promo. So they could have done LOD against Money Inc., and that would have made sense. And then you would round out that card with Shawn Michaels against Marty Jannetty. I mean, that's a hell of a card right there if it all comes together like that. Yeah, and the funny thing is, WrestleMania 8 is still, I think, a really good show. It's one of my favorite WrestleManias, but it could have been so much better. Brianna from Jackson, Mississippi, was listening to your podcast last week about John Cena's greatest opponent coming off the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view. Got me thinking about The Undertaker's many feuds against Mankind, Kane, Shawn Michaels, Triple H, Edge, Brock Lesnar, many others. Who, in your view, is The Undertaker's greatest opponent? That's a great question. When I kind of cut and pasted this over into my my list here of the questions I was going to use, and I saw the names here that you mentioned, I was thinking to myself, man, you know, Undertaker's had a lot of great feuds. And obviously some of his best matches have been with Shawn Michaels. But when I think Undertaker's greatest rival, and I think of Undertaker's greatest feud, I immediately think of Mankind. And there's going to be people who maybe say Kane, because that's the easy answer, right? Oh, they're brothers, and they've had a million matches. Yeah, but that doesn't make him his greatest rival. I still say Mankind is The Undertaker's greatest rival. When Mankind came in, on his very first night, he attacked The Undertaker. So from day one of Mankind's run, he was feuding with The Undertaker. The very first match they ever had was at the King of the Ring in 96, and Mankind beat him. He pinned him. Now, it wasn't totally clean. I think it was an errant shot with the urn to the head, I think. But he beat The Undertaker with a submission hold. Undertaker never verbally submitted or anything, but he put him in the mandible claw. He was out, and the referee called for the bell. When was the last time that a heel came in and beat The Undertaker with a submission hold? So in his first match, he beat The Undertaker, which was a big deal. Then they had the Boiler Room Brawl at SummerSlam, which I thought was a really good match that also doesn't get talked about enough. That was when Paul Bearer did the turn after 6 years. He turned on The Undertaker, went with Mankind. They followed that up with the first ever Buried Alive match. And they probably had a few other matches on TV between then and 98 when they had that Hell in a Cell match. But then, you know, fast forward 2 years later, these guys are still feuding. I mean, granted, it's off and on, but they're still feuding. They're rekindling their feud. They have that Hell in a Cell match at the King of the Ring in 98. And, I mean, we all know what happened there. That match is going to live on in history forever. Some people like it. Some people don't. But that was a fucking war. I mean, that I'm sure that literally took years off Foley's life. So that two-year period there, these guys were just bitter rivals, and I can't think of a better rival for the Undertaker than Mankind. He was the first guy that really came along that felt like Undertaker's equal in a lot of ways. Like, he could beat this guy, and he could take a beating. He was a dark character. Undertaker had the dark character. I think he was the first person to really come along that matched up as well as he did, as well as anybody, really, with Undertaker. And they had some incredible matches. You know, maybe they weren't technical masterpieces like Undertaker had with Shawn Michaels. That's a completely different type of match. But Mankind in 96, when he first came in, the matches with Undertaker, the match with Shawn Michaels, that was Foley at his best in 96. So I'm going to go ahead and say Mankind. I think Mankind is the Undertaker's greatest opponent, and I think he's his greatest rival. Noel writes in, which of these phases of The Rock would you cherish, keep, borrow, or sell? Corporate Champion Rock from 98-99, Babyface Rock from 2000 to 2002, Hollywood Rock from 2003, or Dwayne The Rock Johnson movie star from today? Well, this is clearly a matter of personal preference and not box office, because if it was box office, then Rock of today blows all the other ones away. So cherish, keep, borrow, and sell. I'm cherishing Hollywood Rock. I'm sorry, you can't beat that. Hollywood Rock, the ironic thing is that was probably his shortest run, right? He was the corporate heel champion for longer, he was the babyface for longer, and now he's the big movie star. I mean, that's just what he's going to be from now on. Hollywood Rock was really only a few months. But to me, that's the one I would cherish. As far as keep, I would keep Corporate Rock from 98-99. I would borrow Babyface Rock from 2000 to 2002. And I would sell Movie Star Rock from today, who's great. Yeah, I'm a fan of The Rock. But when you compare that run, that character now that he's got, that persona, to the ones before, I think this is the weakest one. So I would sell that one. Vineet from Mumbai, India. Will Lex Luger ever be inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame? And why isn't he already? Vince has had so many issues with ex-wrestlers, yet that never stopped people from being in the Hall of Fame. Why not Lex? I never saw any evidence of Lex doing something so bad that he shouldn't get in. Vince seems to harbor too much of a grudge with Luger, and I've never heard any rumors on why. Even Eric Bischoff recently told JBL that he did not want Lex in WCW. Luger comes across as a really nice chap, his word, not mine, in some of his recent interviews, and he does not seem to harbor any negative feelings either with Bischoff or McMahon, as is evident from his views on being passed over for the Four Horsemen Hall of Fame induction. Well, there's absolutely no way Lex Luger should have been inducted as part of the Four Horsemen. And the reason he wasn't, well, I guess there's multiple reasons. Obviously, they don't want him in right now, but that was one of the weaker incarnations of the Horsemen. Okay, when I think of the Four Horsemen, I think of the original, or I think of the one that went in, which is with Barry Windham. I think of the original, but I could see why they wouldn't put Ole Anderson, or Ole Anderson wouldn't want to go in. Ole Anderson is bitter to his very core, and probably wants nothing to do with them, and they want nothing to do with him. So it's obvious why the Barry Windham incarnation is the one that went in. And Ric Flair himself actually claims that that was the best version of the Horseman. I don't hear anybody saying that the version with Lex Luger is the best version of the Horseman. I think Luger's going to get in. Luger will be inducted into the Hall of Fame. I don't know when, but I have every reason to believe he is going to get in. He has turned his life around. He does come across like a very nice guy. It's sad to look at him now. You look at Lex Luger, he built his whole career off this amazing physique, one of the best physiques in the business. Now he's all frail. Everything he's been through, he's lucky to be alive. But I look at Lex Luger and it makes me very sad. It's very sad now to look at Lex Luger compared to how he used to be. As a guy that built his whole career based off his body and his physical appearance, he doesn't have much of one now. But he's put a lot of that crap that he's been through behind him. Like I said, he's turned his life around. He seems like a positive person now. And they have brought him in, I think, to interview for some DVDs and stuff. He might have been on Sting's DVD. I haven't seen the whole thing yet. And so I have every reason to think he'll be in the Hall of Fame one day. As far as the heat, you know, there was a lot of heat there. I think it stems from how he left WWE in the mid-90s and jumped over to WCW. He really, from WWE's perspective, they really felt screwed over by him and misled. And Luger may well have just lied to them, and I'm sure he did. And then one day he shows up on Nitro, the very first Nitro. I think a lot of that bad blood comes from that. I know when they bought WCW and they did that Raw Nitro simulcast, I'm pretty sure Vince McMahon name-dropped Luger. Or there was some episode of Raw where Vince mentioned Luger's name, and he did it with such scorn. Yeah, I was like, okay, of all the names he's rattling off here, Luger ain't coming in. And they never did bring him in. And then the stuff happened, I think, in 03 with Luger and Elizabeth. And at the time, WWF had a show on USA called Confidential that would air on Saturday nights, and they did this segment on Elizabeth's death and the 911 call. It was very salacious, shady bullshit that they did, and they tried to make it sound like Lex Luger is the one who killed her. Lex Luger murdered her, which isn't entirely true. They were together, stuff was going on, whatever. I don't remember all the details, but she died, I think, in the same home they were living together, and it was very suspicious and all that. But WWE went all the way with it. Oh, we're going to make it sound like Luger murdered her. I mean, what a, you know, I mean, it was just, I don't know. It's very slimy to me. I'm amazed that Luger doesn't still harbor ill will towards them for that, but it seems like, you know, all is forgiven from his end. And I'm sure it will be from WWE's end one day, too. He's going to get into the Hall of Fame. It's just a matter of time. Time heals all wounds. These wounds don't seem like they can't be overcome, and I'm sure they will at some point. Dylan, from Billings, Montana. My question pertains to the superkick. Do you think that it is the most overrated maneuver in wrestling today due to the fact that it's used by a number of different wrestlers? I don't know if you mean overrated or overused. I'm going to assume you mean overused, which it absolutely is. But Dylan says, I'm a Shawn Michaels fan, and Sweet Chin Music meant something when he connected with it. Today, it doesn't even win matches. I wanted to know your take on the superkick and if it's being used too often by too many wrestlers. Yes. Yes, yes, yes. I think that goes without saying. Maybe you could make a list. Somebody should make a list of all the guys in the WWE roster alone that have some form of a superkick, or which the announcers usually refer to as a superkick. It's not like they call it a... Like Gorilla Monsoon used to call some of these kicks a savate kick. Oh, he gave him a reverse crescent kick. Remember when Shawn Michaels started doing the superkick? That's what Gorilla Monsoon would call it. Reverse crescent kick. It's a superkick. Somebody needs to make a list of all the guys in the WWE roster that use superkicks on a regular basis. I'm willing to bet that's a pretty long list. Now, you have the Young Bucks. Some people absolutely hate the Young Bucks. They think they're a fucking parody. They're everything that's wrong with wrestling. They can't stand them. I find the Young Bucks fun. I think they're perfectly fine, capable pro wrestlers. They do that style the way they do it because it works and because that's what people want to see. They're obviously doing very well for themselves. They just earned themselves a very nice contract with Ring of Honor. Not an exclusive contract, like some people say, but a contract nonetheless. And I personally like the Young Bucks. I know some people don't. They obviously overuse super kicks, but that's part of their shtick. That's their whole gimmick. So that's kind of what they do. If we take away the fact that they do that on purpose because it's their gimmick, you look at other people in Ring of Honor and in WWE, pretty much every promotion, but especially Ring of Honor and WWE, everybody uses some form of a super kick now. It's ridiculous. And you're right, they don't win matches with it. Who wins matches these days with a super kick? Like on a regular basis. Maybe every now and then they'll get a win, like Del Rio did against Cena. But nobody does. Nobody wins on a regular basis with that as like some kind of finishing move. It's been prostituted so much now. You know, but yeah, you could say the same thing about a lot of moves in wrestling. It's not just the super kick. It's just, that's just how it is. You know, I don't necessarily agree with it, but that's just how it is now. Everybody uses everybody else's move, and then everybody kicks out from it. Gene from Miami. Will WWE ever induct Demolition into the Hall of Fame? Well, they better. I've been crowing about this for years. And I think they will go in. Here's my fear, though, okay? You have Axe and Smash. Okay, Barry Darso and Bill Eadie, who are still alive, which is amazing when you consider a lot of the guys from that period of wrestling that they came up in who are not around anymore or are in such bad physical shape they couldn't even go to the Hall of Fame if they were ever invited. And Axe and Smash, they're still doing matches every now and then. They do conventions. They've done some shoot interviews. And Bill Eadie, who played Axe, people ask sometimes, well, why'd they ever bring in Crush? Why'd they make Demolition a trio in the early 90s? And he's told the story before. He had like an allergic reaction, I think, to shellfish, and it affected his heart. He's had some medical issues before, but he's still going. You know, he's still alive and kicking, and so is Barry Darso. And I hate to be morbid about it, but, you know, when it comes to wrestlers from that 70s, 80s, 90s, especially 80s and 90s, I mean, you get to a certain age, you better strike while the iron is hot, because you don't know what tomorrow's going to bring. And I still, you know, will never forgive Vince McMahon for waiting so long to put Randy Savage in the Hall of Fame that by the time he finally went in, he wasn't around to accept the induction and give the speech. I think if Randy Savage had given his Hall of Fame induction speech, it would have been the best speech of all time. And we were deprived of that as fans because Vince had whatever this grudge was against Randy, whatever his reasons were, he waited so freaking long, and then the guy drops dead, and it's like, you waited too long, right? But you could do that with other people too. Demolition should already be in the Hall of Fame. You know, Demolition was conceived of because Vince couldn't get his hands on the Road Warriors back in the day. That's why people think of Demolition as a Road Warriors ripoff. I don't, because when I grew up a WWF fan, so I knew Demolition probably before I even knew LOD. I mean, I became familiar with the Road Warriors shortly thereafter. And I never said, oh, the Road Warriors are ripoffs of Demolition. I could see the similarities between the two teams. But Demolition, you know, was very successful. You know, normally when you have a couple of knockoffs like that, they don't always do so well. Demolition, 3-time tag team champions, had some big WrestleMania matches, very, very popular during their run, still popular today. That's why you got a lot of people who want to see them in the Hall of Fame. I just think it would be cool to get them on stage together, to hear that Rick Derringer music one more time. And you know, they deserve as much as anybody from that period to be in there, especially when you see some of the other people they put in. But I feel like they wait so long with some of these guys, they're going to wait so long that, you know, and God forbid, but something's going to happen to one of them, and then you're only going to have one member of Demolition. It's like, what the fuck are you waiting for? Put these guys in. You got to start some kind of movement to get Demolition into the Hall of Fame here. Start some kind of freaking movement on social media, since that's all they pay attention to these days. But yeah, I think they'll be in, and I wish they would go in sooner rather than later. I hope they go in next year. You know, I think every year they need to look for a headliner, a good solid tag team, a female, maybe an international star. And I could see Jushin Liger, for example, going in next year, right? They're obviously on good terms with him, and he's a legendary figure. He could be the international person who goes in next year. And as far as tag teams go, I mean, I know they'll probably put the Freebirds in, although I look at them more as a, yeah, like a faction, not so much a tag team. And the Freebirds deserve to go in, especially in Dallas. It's the perfect place for it. I think Demolition should go in, too. It's way overdue. London from Pittsburgh. That sounds weird, but that's the person's name, London. Why has WWE never officially had a WCW one-night stand? Just seems weird considering they had two for ECW, yet none for WCW, which was their major rival. They had a night back in 01 with Buff Bagwell against Booker T, but that's as close as they've come. Do you think it would be cool if they did one now? Well, you mentioned Buff Bagwell against Booker T. That might give you a little insight into why they never did a WCW one-night stand. That one match collapsed. Oh, my God. Just all the plans that just fell to the wayside because of that one fucking match. It is unbelievable. I'm trying to think in my head if there is another match in the modern era that had as much of an impact or fallout from it as that match. I guess you could say Montreal, given what came out of it, but Booker T and Buff Bagwell has got to be way up there on that list. I mean, if you go back in time and read some of the old like newsletters, observers, torches, and that kind of stuff, I mean, it is well documented. All of the planning, the meticulous planning that was going into creating a WCW brand, and that one match in Tacoma, Washington, just the crowd reaction to it, Vince McMahon just completely changed course and said, we're not doing this. It's unbelievable. But as far as doing a WCW one-night stand now, no. I've actually never had any interest in seeing it. It's even less so now. WCW has been dead for, what, 15 years now? 14, 15 years? I think that time has come and gone. And here's the other reason why. A lot of those WCW guys came to WWE pretty early on. It wouldn't feel like a WCW show anymore. Those guys now, they feel like WWE guys. Right? Booker T and Kevin Nash and all those other people. Hulk Hogan. Like, those are WWE guys. What do you need to do a WCW show for? ECW, at least, that was a completely different brand, a completely different everything. It was different enough. And there was a cult following that it had. You know, there's a reason you would hear ECW chants in the crowd. You still do every now and then. But for years and years and years, people were, oh, ECW, ECW. You never heard WCW chants. Name me one time since WCW died, and probably even when they were still alive. But especially since they died. Name one time that you heard WCW chants from a crowd. You never did, because it never happened. So, no, I don't want to see one, and I don't expect them to ever do one. Anthony from the UK, buy or sell. Heel Goldberg in 2000 WCW or heel Stone Cold in 2001 WWF? I'm buying heel Austin. I'm selling heel Goldberg. They were both bad decisions. I guess Austin's more so in hindsight. Even he admits that now. I think most people at the time knew that turning Goldberg was a stupid move. Pretty sure that was a Russo idea. I know he was definitely there during that period, so it would fit. Now, the Goldberg turn just, it didn't make any sense. It was just like, it was done for shock value. Which most definitely reeks of Russo, now that I think about it. It didn't work. It was a disaster. It killed Goldberg even deader than he probably already was by that point. At least the Austin heel turn, as bad of a move as that turned out to be, he wouldn't, you know, and like I said before, Austin has said, if he can go back in time, he wouldn't do it. He would beat The Rock, and instead of shaking hands with Vince, he would give him a stunner. That's what Austin says. So, he did the heel turn. At least it was entertaining. Crazy, psycho heel Austin and the comedy stuff with him and Kurt Angle, that stuff was amazing. It was legit entertaining, laugh-out-loud funny. But they were both bad moves. Austin's did more damage business-wise, but that's mostly because WWF business was so far ahead of WCW's at the time. Of course, they had further to fall. Part of that may have been the fact that The Rock, who became the de facto number one babyface at that time, was gone right after WrestleMania. He left to go film a movie. I'm sure that didn't help business at all. They had to go with Undertaker and Kane as the two top babyfaces until Rock came back. So it was Undertaker and Kane against Austin and Triple H. Then Jericho and Benoit got the chance to wrestle for the championship and be the top babyfaces before Rock came back. But that heel turn coincided with a steady decline in ratings and business. I mean, the numbers went down. And it's not a coincidence why. That was not an accident. Stone Cold Steve Austin, the biggest babyface of the modern era, you know, after the Hogan period at least, And think of all the business this guy did, and the ratings, and the t-shirts, and the pay-per-view buy rates, and the ticket sales, and everything. And he went away, he had the neck surgery, came back. I think he was cooled off a little bit by that point, wasn't the same Austin as in 98-99. But he comes back, and you turn him heel. And it's not just that you turn him heel. You have him shake hands with the one guy that he was feuding with for all those years, right? It was always the employee against the boss. Now the employee is shaking hands with the boss. There were a lot of casual wrestling fans that saw that and said, fuck this, I'm out of here. You know, they weren't really that married to pro wrestling. They didn't give a shit. They just were big fans of Stone Cold and the Attitude Era. I mean, that's why you had fucking sixes and sevens on as far as the ratings every single week. It was absolutely crazy. A lot of those people saw that and said, I'm done. That's it. You know? It's over. And they went away, and they never came back. So, you know, you keep Austin babyface at WrestleMania that year, if you do that, and you do a full-fledged WCW invasion, bring a few more big names in right from the get-go, Don't bring him in 2 years later, 3 years later. If you do that, okay, keep Austin babyface, do the WCW invasion, you do it with Flair and Goldberg, or maybe Sting, Hogan, some combination of those guys. You don't need all of them, just some of them. And you bring him in, led by Eric Bischoff, the guy who fired Austin, right, from WCW back in the day. That's a hell of an angle right there. You want to talk about the invasion angle done right, that would have been the way to do it. Put the belt on Austin, keep him babyface, bring in some actual big stars. All due respect to Booker T and DDP. They were big names in WCW. But I don't think that when WCW went under, and they bought them and they were going to do this invasion angle, I don't think that when people envisioned the fantasy scenario of a WCW invasion or a big supercard, that the guys that would be leading the invasion and the biggest names that would be coming over would be DDP and Booker T. Okay, that was a bit of a letdown. So imagine if you do it this way. See, now that's money. But to go back to the original question, there were at least parts of the Austin heel turn that I thought were very enjoyable. The Goldberg turn, there was nothing enjoyable about it. It was just stupid. Daryl from Hartford, Connecticut, has maybe the toughest buy or sell that I've had to do in all the months I've been doing this. Bret Hart or Kurt Angle? Who is the better all-around pro wrestler and who is more popular as a talent? That is a loaded question. Anybody who listens to this podcast knows that, you know, if I were asked, who's your favorite wrestler of all time? Bret Hart is my pick, especially Bret Hart from that mid-90s, like 92 to 94-ish period. He was my personal favorite, if I had to pick one. That being said, having a favorite wrestler and answering a question where somebody wants me to, talk about who is the better all-around pro wrestler, right? I think I can separate the two. And, well, I'll give you my answer first. And it's very close because these guys are two of the best Hall of Famer, first ballot Hall of Famers, just two of the very best that there's ever been in wrestling. I have to buy on Kurt Angle and sell on Bret Hart. I wish I can give like a more wishy-washy kind of answer and buy both or whatever, but I try to, like, you got to give an answer. I try to give an answer, and so I'm going to say buy Kurt and sell Bret. And here's why. To me, Bret Hart was always, he was just the quintessential pro wrestler. You know, he wore pink, okay, fine. But he looked the part, he came out there, slapping hands with the fans, giving the glasses to the kid at ringside. He'd get in the ring, he could have great matches with almost anybody. Okay, not everybody, he had some stinkers, but he could go in there and have a good to great match with almost anybody. Which is a quality I think that Kurt Angle shares as well. Bret Hart, to this day, to me, is the best at going in the ring and telling a story, ring psychology, you know, that sort of thing. Bret Hart took a beating like nobody else. When I watched his matches back in the day, it felt like this guy was getting his ass kicked, and he would sell and sell and sell, and then usually would get the comeback there at the end. If Bret Hart, let's say, had a body part worked over in the course of a match, he didn't forget about it. He always remembered it, whether it would come back to factor into the finish, or even if it didn't. Even if it was just something that he would sell the shoulder, sell the hand, sell the knee, whatever it was. I think back to the King of the Ring in 93. Okay, one of the matches in the countdown we've been doing here on the podcast every week, the Top 8 Countdown, I picked a few weeks ago, Bret Hart against Mr. Perfect in the King of the Ring 1993 semifinals. Now, if you remember, I know a lot of you went back and watched the match. Bret came out with his fingers all taped up. Now, why were his fingers taped up? Because in the opening round, at the beginning of the show, he wrestled Razor Ramon. There was a part in that match where Razor stomped on his hand. Bret was on all fours, and Razor just stomped on his fingers. So I don't know. Now, look, maybe it was a legitimate injury. Maybe he stomped a little too hard, and he was actually hurt for real. I'm guessing not. So when Bret came out for the match later on, he had his fingers taped up. And he was selling the fact that, you know, his fingers were hurt. He was the walking wounded, but there he was. He was coming back out. He was going to wrestle Mr. Perfect. During the match, I think Perfect was bending the fingers back at one point. You just felt for this guy. Like, ah, that's got to hurt. Bret was awesome at that kind of stuff. Ring psychology, classic old school wrestler. to this day, in my opinion, still the best. Kurt Angle, look, no slouch. I don't think of Kurt Angle as like a great master ring psychologist or anything like that. I would definitely give Brett the edge over him when it comes to that. But when I think to their actual matches and the number of great matches they had and the kind of opponents they had, again, very, very similar in that these guys could go in there and wrestle almost anybody and bring a good match out of them. I mean, Bret Hart did it a whole bunch of times in 94, 95 with Kevin Nash. Some of Nash's best matches, aside from that one with Shawn Michaels before Nash left, a lot of his best matches were with Bret Hart. They weren't with Sid. They weren't with Mabel. You know, they weren't with the British Bulldog. I can remember a match with Bulldog and Diesel that was the fucking drizzling shits. October 95 in your house. I remember reading that when the show was over, Vince McMahon was so fucking disgusted with what he had just seen, he threw his headset down. And Bulldog was not a bad wrestler, but couldn't get a good match out of Diesel. Bret Hart, though, he went in there at Survivor Series in 95 and had a pretty damn good match with Diesel. Kurt Angle. You know, Kurt Angle could go in there too, and I can't remember very many bad Kurt Angle matches that I've seen. The thing with Kurt, I still say that Kurt Angle had probably the best first year of anybody in wrestling that I've ever seen. At least, again, in terms of like WWE coming up, being on TV, the best first year of anybody I've ever seen, except maybe for Brock Lesnar. Brock Lesnar might have him beat out just because Brock won the championship like Kurt did, but Brock was like a top guy a little before Kurt was. Kurt won the title his first year too, but Kurt wasn't in a Hell in a Cell match beating The Undertaker in his first year. So I will say that Brock probably has the slight advantage, but still, Kurt Angle, one of the best first years you'll ever see. He was great from day one. Kurt came in, he debuted the end of 99. I don't know if that was always the plan, that let's bring this guy in, he'll be a little goofy, and people will turn on him, or if it just happened where they were booing him, and they said, hey, let's go with this. I don't know, like the chicken or the egg, which came first. I couldn't tell you. I don't know. But I'm happy they did what they did. Because Kurt Angle, as the goofy Olympian, was awesome. And it's amazing to see his transformation year to year to year. So that first year, year and a half, he was the goofy guy who could really wrestle. In 01, that was already starting to change, and by the middle of the year, by the fall of that year, Kurt really wasn't the goofball anymore. Right? When Austin was part of the alliance during the invasion, you know, 9/11 happened, it was right around that time, Kurt was the American hero. In 2002... He was still doing some goofy stuff, you know. I remember some real funny promos with him and Rey Mysterio. The one where he said, you know, you're a little boy, and I have to go look that promo up. Like, I like little boys or something. Like, Kurt was still doing some funny stuff. Even with Edge. The feud with Edge. Kurt got his head shaved. For like 2 months, he wore the amateur wrestling headgear with the wig. It's fucking hilarious. But people still took Kurt Angle seriously. By 03... he was really getting away from the comedy in 04, 05. By then, he was like a completely different guy. I mean, he was the wrestling machine. When they moved him over to the ECW brand, that was the Kurt Angle. He put the mouth guard in, and you didn't want to get in the ring with him because if you did, you knew you were going to get fucked up. Think about how Kurt Angle evolved that character from late 99 to 05, 06 when he left. It was like a complete transformation. But the one thing is, throughout that entire run, no matter how goofy, no matter what, you know, kind of campy comedy he may have been doing, everybody knew Kurt was the real deal. Everybody took the guy seriously. He was the perfect pro wrestler in a lot of ways because he could wrestle, right? It was nice to have a guy that actually knew how to work. So he took that amateur wrestling background and applied it to his craft in pro wrestling, and it worked. He was an amazing performer. He was not afraid to make fun of himself and do the comedy stuff, because he knew that was part of pro wrestling. It was all about being entertaining. It was being a character. From day one, this guy got it. There wasn't a huge learning curve here for him, it seems like. Now, compare that to Bret Hart, and I love Bret Hart to death, but the thing is, if you look at Bret Hart from beginning to end, he never really changed. I mean, yeah, he went from heel to face to heel, and he was doing the anti-US thing, and he was playing a character, but Bret Hart was always himself. He came out, there really wasn't a whole lot of fancy stuff to it. His character never really changed. He was never really considered a funny guy. His promos got better over the years. I don't think he was ever really looked at as being a strong promo guy. He got better at it, but it's not like he was blowing people away. Bret Hart, what you see is what you get. He never really evolved. He never really evolved that character. Even when he went to WCW, which was a complete waste, he looked lost. It's just they never really did anything with him. He had a couple of highlights here, right? He won the WCW title. That great moment where Goldberg gave him the spear and he revealed he was wearing like a metal plate under his shirt. Like, there were some moments that he had in WCW that were memorable, but that run was largely a waste. It was a complete waste of Bret, and it was almost like he didn't even want to be there. And it's kind of sad that his career ended that way. It ended in WCW where they did nothing with him, and then he got hurt. Now, Kurt almost has this whole second career. So he leaves WWE. Almost immediately, he ends up in TNA. And he's going to be leaving TNA in January. He has said he will not re-sign with them. So how many years is that he spent in TNA? I believe the length of his TNA run now exceeds the length of his original WWE run, which just blows my mind when I think about that. But I do believe he has spent more years in TNA than he ever did with WWE. He went to TNA, and he was a top guy from day one. He actually was one of the very few guys TNA ever brought in that made a difference at the beginning. After a while, he didn't, because nobody ever really does. Sting, Hogan, Flair, I mean, the list goes on and on of guys that they've brought in, and they haven't made a lick of difference. Maybe a negative impact, not so much a positive one. But at the beginning, Kurt did have a positive impact. And you look at the stuff that Kurt did with Samoa Joe. Kurt Angle and Samoa Joe, to their credit, headlined a pay-per-view that did something like 60,000 buys, which is by far the most number of buys TNA has ever done for a pay-per-view show in its history. They never hit that number before. They've never hit that number since. And that match, I think that match probably took place in like 07, 08. That's how many years ago this goes back. So, of course, naturally, you know, they found a formula that works, TNA did, and then they said, wow, this works so great, let's never do it again. And they never did. So Kurt went to TNA, continued to have great matches, continued to perform at a high level, made an impact there, at least early on. And even now, I mean, all the injuries, all the time off, Kurt Angle can still go out there and perform at a high level and have at least a very good match. That's pretty incredible. It's the tale of two careers with Kurt Angle. That's pretty impressive. Bret was never able to do that in WCW, and then he got hurt. But Kurt Angle, when you really look at his body of work and what he's been able to do, spread out across two different promotions, and evolving that character the way that he has, still performing at a high level, making the other guy look good, not afraid to take risks, even if it's to his own detriment, okay, all the moonsaults off the cages, I never have to see that again. And I will say, Kurt Angle probably has one of the most beautiful moonsaults I've ever seen in a wrestling ring. I just don't want to see him doing it from 20 feet up. So when you really look at their body of work and you ask yourself, who was the better all-around pro wrestler? Neither one of them were bad. They're two of the very best that there's ever been. Bret Hart recognizes that. I think Bret Hart even has told the story at least once before of waking up in the middle of the night from a dream. He was actually dreaming that he was in like a wrestling hold with Kurt Angle. This guy was having dreams about wrestling Kurt Angle. That's how badly he would have loved to have had a match with him. And I think, look, that's a match everybody would have wanted to see. That's one of those all-time dream matches that we'll never have a chance to see in their prime, Kurt Angle against Bret Hart. I mean, you talk about pretty incredible. I can only imagine the kind of match those two guys would have put together. But their careers mirror each other in so many ways, and they've had so many great classic matches. You can't really prioritize one over the other. But when I think of all around, everything, not just technical ability, but everything that goes into building like the perfect pro wrestler, Kurt Angle is it. And I got to give him the edge over Bret Hart, as much as it pains me to do that. So like I said at the beginning, I'm going to buy on Kurt, I'm going to sell on Bret, and hopefully I did at least a halfway decent explanation of explaining why. And we'll end here with match number 7. In our countdown, 8 of my favorite WWE matches of all time. Just to recap, we've been doing this now 7 weeks, no particular order. Match number one was the 1992 Royal Rumble. Match number two was Steve Austin against Dude Love at Over the Edge 98. Match number three was Shawn Michaels against The Undertaker at WrestleMania 25. Match number four was Bret Hart against Mr. Perfect from The King of the Ring in 1993. Match number five was The Shield against the Wyatt Family at Elimination Chamber 2014. And match number six was the 10-man tag from Raw on February 7th of 2000, with Triple H and X-Pac and the Radicals against The Rock, Cactus Jack, Rikishi, and Too Cool. And I'll tell you what was cool. I got so many messages from you guys about you went back and you found the match online, since you can't find it on the network, stupidly. You found it online, you watched it, and not a bad word to say about it. Everybody that went back and watched that match just raved about the crowd and the atmosphere, and it was just awesome. So, and there were some people who had never seen it before. That's one of the cool things about doing this countdown. So now we do match number seven. And this is a match that goes back to the Attitude Era. Again, I think this is the second or third Attitude Era match on this list, which I, you know, until I wrote my list out, and I had to really narrow it down all those weeks ago, okay, what matches do I want to focus on here? Even I was kind of surprised. I didn't expect that many matches from that period, because when you think of the Attitude Era, you don't really think great wrestling matches. You think of almost everything but. And that's not even really fair. When you think about a great wrestling match, it's not just, you know, technical. There actually were a lot of really fun matches during that period. Austin versus Dude Love, you know, which is on this list, is one of them. And, you know, that wasn't a technical masterpiece, but that match had everything that I look for in a fun wrestling match. And this is a match, the one that we're doing this week, that took me by surprise. And I think it took a lot of people by surprise, in that it was so much better than it had any right to be. And it was a match from SummerSlam of 1999. It was a Greenwich Street fight, love her or leave her match, between Test and Shane McMahon. Shane McMahon never, to my knowledge, had any formal pro wrestling training. He was the son of, you know, the great Vince McMahon, who I'm sure was able to work out in a gym somewhere and take bumps, but I don't think Shane ever had any formal training. And from day one, I think Shane was very impressive. I don't know if Shane's first match ever was the X-Pac match at WrestleMania 15. I guess it wouldn't have been, because I think he was already European champion, so he had to wrestle on Raw. But Shane, you know, when he came into SummerSlam here, he only had a couple of matches under his belt. I don't think Shane had wrestled that many matches before this match here with Test. Only a handful, which makes it even more impressive. Test was also relatively new. He had come into the company, I believe, at the very end of 98 as like a bodyguard enforcer type. He was part of the corporation. And Test is another one who I think he was very new to the business. He did not really have a lot of experience. I don't know if he ever worked indies or anything like that. If he did, it probably wasn't for very long. He was a big guy, 7 foot tall. And so you think to yourself, okay, I'm going to take Test, who's still pretty green, and I'm going to take Shane McMahon, who's not even really a wrestler, and let's put him in a singles match and see what happens. It was a risk, but it was a risk that paid off, because I'll tell you what, they went out there and they had a hell of a match. And, you know, Shane, it's funny, we haven't really seen or heard a lot from Shane in recent years. Shane was actually spotted with Batista at the premiere of the new Bond movie, which I know Batista is in. I can't wait to see it. But, yeah, Big Dave went on Twitter and he posted a photo of him and Shane McMahon. So if you want to take a look at what Shane's looking like these days, you can head on over to his Twitter page. But to give some backstory here to this match, they had a storyline going at the time where Test and Stephanie McMahon became romantically involved. And this did not sit well with Shane McMahon. He was the overprotective brother. He wanted to take Test out of the picture, which is what led to the stipulation here in this match. It was a street fight, but it was called Love Her or Leave Her. So I believe the idea was that if Test couldn't win, then he couldn't date Stephanie. And if he did, he would effectively be winning the right to date her and to go on a date with her. They both come out. All of a sudden, the Posse's music hits. The Mean Street Posse. One of my favorite parts of the Attitude Era was the Mean Street Posse. It was Pete Gass, Rodney, and Joey Abs. Now, Joey Abs, I think, had been an independent wrestler. They kind of just plugged in there. Rodney and Pete Gass were legit friends of Shane McMahon, going back to Shane's, I think, high school days. And they just came in to be part of the Mean Street Posse, which makes it even cooler. So in the weeks leading up to the match, Test had taken out each member of the posse. He kicked their ass. They came out. One of them had a neck brace. The other one had a walking boot on. The other one, I think, had a cast on his hand. So out they come. They had a couch set up in the front row for them to sit. They were drinking champagne. And right from the get-go, you know, Test went after Shane, and they were off to the races. You know, they were just, you know, beating the hell out of each other. They would show Stephanie watching from backstage on a small monitor and actually staring straight ahead into the TV, not like that nonsense they do now where you've got to stand. It's so weird. They have to stand, like, facing the camera but have their head turned to the TV. It's like, it's ridiculous. Much like everything they do these days. Completely ridiculous. I notice these little things now when I go back and I watch these matches from 15, 20 years ago. Like little, like camera angles and replays. We talked about that earlier. And it's just, it was so much better back then. I hate to be one of those guys who was like, oh, back in the day, it was so much better. But seriously, there were so many little things that they could be doing now to improve the product and the TV show and the matches. Just in terms of how they're filmed and things they do and commentary. And they don't do it. And you say to yourself, like, there's so many issues that you have with the product today, things that maybe you would like to change. But there's so many little things, I feel like, if you take all those little things and you put them all together, it equals one big thing. And this is one of those little things that just annoys me. So anyway, Stephanie's staring straight ahead, as she should, into this little monitor backstage, and she looks very concerned. Every time Test is being beaten down, she's very concerned. And the posse, of course, they got involved. At one point, Test threw Shane into them and the couch fell backwards, which was kind of funny. But Shane at one point took a picture frame that had a picture, I believe it was a picture of the posse, smashed it over Test's head, glass or fake glass, whatever it was, went shattered, went all over the place. And they're bringing in all kinds of weapons, street signs. I think Jerry Lawler was like, hey, that's a do not enter sign from Greenwich Avenue. And they had a mailbox at one point. I don't know where they got it from, but the posse handed Test a mailbox. He hit Test in the head with it, or Shane hit Test in the head with it, I should say. So this was really just one giant brawl. And they did that, I'm sure, on purpose, because, again, these were not two very experienced wrestlers. So, you know, to have just a straight wrestling match would have been an even bigger risk. So they had the stipulation where they could use weapons and stuff, and so that helped. Shane, though, was a fearless fucker, let me tell you that. At one point in the match, he tried a corkscrew moonsault that missed, and he landed right on his knees. But it looked great. You know, the thing I have to say about Shane, he was fearless. He was not afraid to take chances. He would try new things. Sometimes it would work, sometimes it wouldn't. He was a lot of fun to watch. That's the thing about Shane McMahon. He was never boring to watch. It was always fun to watch a Shane McMahon match. And part of that was it got to the point where you were just waiting for him to take that one big risk. And I'm kind of glad that he stopped doing it, because I think back to that SummerSlam match with Steve Blackman where Shane basically fell, what, 50 feet probably, maybe more? I mean, he was falling from a great height. At some point, you're just asking for trouble. But he was always a lot of fun to watch, and same thing here in this match. The posse just kept getting involved, and Test would fight them off, and they would get involved again. And so at one point, they actually set Test up on the Spanish announce table outside the ring. And they told Shane, hey, go up to the top. Shane climbed to the top rope, did a diving elbow from the top rope out of the ring, right onto Test. The announce table shatters. There's a great spot. And they're both laid out. They put Test in the ring. Shane covers him, gets a near fall out of it. And there were a couple of near falls in this match. The crowd was so into the match. They were super into it that Test would get the shoulder up right at the last possible second, and the place would go nuts. And that happened a couple of different times. And it culminated with Patterson and Briscoe coming out at the end. Patterson and Briscoe had their issues with the posse. They even wrestled them on TV once. Patterson and Briscoe come out. They beat up the posse. They even the odds out a little bit. Pump handle slam into a power slam, or pump handle, I should say, into a power slam for Test. Lays out Shane, goes up top, flying elbow from Test. Gets the pin. He wins the right to date Stephanie McMahon. Stephanie McMahon comes out. She looks so happy. She's running to the ring, and she embraces Test, and she looks down at her brother, and she's got kind of a disappointed look on her face. They told a great story here. They really, really did. And the people were into it. And not just the match. I think they were into the story as well. They really wanted to see this guy win. They wanted to see Test go out with Stephanie McMahon. And I think maybe on some level they could relate to the whole idea of the overprotective older brother. It just worked. You know, the story, the match, everything clicked. It was just near perfect. The crowd ate it up. And Test was so over at this point that it's kind of mind-blowing to me how they dropped the ball with this guy. Because as over as he was, they could have done so much more with him. And it just felt like by the end of the year when they did the swerve and it was Triple H instead who married Stephanie and not Test, that was it for Test. And whether you want to blame Triple H if he had something to do with the push getting cut off, I don't know. I'm trying to come up with explanations in my mind for it. You know, maybe Triple H had something to do with it, maybe he didn't. He certainly benefited from it, I know that. But after that, it was like they never really did anything with Test. You know, he did some stuff. He became the tag team with Albert. But it was never the same. This actually was the peak of Test as a singles performer in wrestling. It's kind of sad, really, that this was as good as it ever got for the guy. Because this match right here, I think it opened a lot of eyes. And if it didn't, it should have. That this guy could have been so much more than he was. And maybe part of it was his own fault. I don't know. Maybe he was doing stuff he shouldn't have been doing. I don't know that we'll ever know the full answer. But they really did drop the ball. And they just didn't take advantage of it. It's plain and simple. They just never did. And Shane went on to have a lot of other matches where he just did unbelievably crazy, stupid stuff. I still think of the Kurt Angle match at King of the Ring the year after this. He took so much abuse in that match. Falling on his head, being suplexed through the glass. He's a crazy man. But I think people respected Shane for it because they knew, you know, he wanted to wrestle. He could have gone in there and wrestled and played it safe. He's the boss's son. But he went in there and for the sake of putting on a great performance, I mean, he would fucking put his own life at risk. And he wasn't an embarrassment in the ring. He could have easily gone in there and could have been booed out of the building. I think even today, all the respect that people have for work rate and all these indie guys that come up and they want to cheer for the indie guys and boo Roman Reigns because, oh, Roman Reigns didn't work Ring of Honor. Like, who cares? Like, seriously. But if Shane McMahon came along now, I don't think he'd be booed. Even by those same people who love, you know, Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn, and you got to work your way up on the indies for 15 years. If Shane McMahon came waltzing in right now and he was Vince McMahon's son and he was in matches like this, people would still respect the guy. And they would respect him because he didn't go in there and embarrass himself. So I will always have a tremendous amount of respect for Shane as a performer. I miss Shane. He's probably the one McMahon I actually miss. I'm so sick of all the other ones. It's too bad we don't get to see him more often. Wasn't really a fan so much of the feud with Randy Orton in 09, which I think was the last time Shane was involved with anything. Kind of made Randy Orton look like a fool, but aside from that, I very much enjoyed Shane's work. And again, Test, if you want to see the best Test match there ever was, I dare you to find me a better one. This was probably it right here, and it's a lot of fun. SummerSlam 99, Test and Shane McMahon. It was a revelation at that time. How good this match was compared to how bad it could have been. And next week, we will wrap this up. Match number 8 in the countdown. 8 of my favorite WWE matches of all time. It is the match when I originally put this list together, and I didn't realize at that time that that 10-man tag from last week wasn't on the network. I said there was one match in the countdown that you could not find on the network. You could only find it online. And that is this match. I've saved it for last. That's all I'm going to say about it. I don't want to give any more hints. We'll talk about it next week. Although if I had to say one thing, you probably are not going to guess what it is. You can try to guess, but you're probably not going to be able to. So that's coming up next week. Keep emailing me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter, @solemonster is my handle. You can support the show by making a PayPal donation on thesolemonster.com. Please consider signing up for an Audible trial using our link and get your free book, audibletrial.com/solemonster. and buy a shirt in our Pro Wrestling Tee store, prowrestlingtees.com/SolomonsterSoundsOff. We have over 20 shirts to choose from. They ship all over the world up to a size 5XL. And if you do order a shirt when you get it, if you want to take a picture of yourself wearing it, you can tweet it to me or Facebook it to me, and I will be sure to retweet for the world to see. Always love seeing people in Sound Up shirts. So you could pick them up there. We will be back next weekend. Next weekend, of course, is our 8-year anniversary show. It's not going to be any different than normal. I feel like we kind of just did that. We had episode 400. These two milestones are, they kind of came up around the same time here. And we did that big montage. I'm not planning anything like that next week other than the end of our countdown. But it is a special show to me because it does represent 8 years since the very first episode I ever did. And I never would have been expected, or I never would have expected, I should say, to still be doing this 8 years later and for this to be as big for me as it is. It's really very cool, and I have all you guys to thank for that. So it'll have a special meaning for me next week. But other than that, it'll be business as usual. Hope you'll join me. Until then, be well, stay safe, and that's it. I'm out of here. We'll see you right back here again next week. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
Watch these promos on NXT. Watch Raw. Watch a Randy Orton promo or a Sheamus promo. They never, ever look at the camera. It's because that's what they teach them now. You are not allowed to look into the camera. I think it's just completely idiotic. Why are their eyes not on me? That's how interviews always work. They're talking to me. They're speaking to us. They're supposed to be speaking to the fans. Maybe that's part of the reason why these people can't make a connection with the audience. Because they don't fucking look at us.
Solomonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, the Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster Sound Off.